This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, September 15th, 2011. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, disasters in the U.S. have put pressure on FEMA, but a debate in Congress threatens much-needed funds.
You're going to have some unfortunate occurrences. We need to plan all of this into the budget process.
In Guatemala, a former military leader from the country's brutal war is poised to take the presidency. And we'll go to India, where a collective effort brings solar energy to remote villages. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Alice Olstein with headlines for FSRN. Human rights advocates are condemning tonight's scheduled execution in Texas of Dwayne Buck, who was given the death penalty for killing his ex-girlfriend and her friend in 1995. His attorneys say the sentencing was compromised by a psychologist testifying under oath that Buck being an African-American made him a greater threat to society. Amnesty International's Brian Evans calls the case racist at its core.
Texas needs to call off the execution to show that they are even minimally concerned that justice be applied fairly.
The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals rejected Buck's motion for a stay of execution on Wednesday night, and the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles decided unanimously not to recommend that Governor Rick Perry commute Buck's sentence to life in prison. Perry, who was recently cheered for his record 234 executions during a Republican primary debate, is now the only person who could call off tonight's lethal injection. In Tacoma, Washington, striking teachers defied a court order sending them back to work. Without enough staff to keep the schools open, classes have been canceled for a third day. FSRN's Jess Burns reports.
The teachers were back on the picket lines this morning, even though a judge in Tacoma issued a restraining order on Wednesday. The order required the 1,900 public school teachers to return to work and for both sides to return to negotiations in good faith. The judge's decision was not met enthusiastically by teachers who rallied Wednesday afternoon.
They're trying to scare you. If we all refuse to go back, they cannot punish all of us. Do not be afraid.
Audio from a rally video posted on YouTube. The Tacoma Education Association and school district are still at odds over issues of pay, class sizes, and employee transfers. Further negotiations between the union and districts were slated for this afternoon. Jess Burns, FSRN.
After 6 months of violent suppression, Syrian opposition members said they will form a national council to present a united front against President Bashar Assad. The popular uprising began in March, and the UN estimates that 2,600 people have been killed. 10 were killed today when security forces raided a farm in the south of the country. The statement released by the newly created Syrian National Council calls for a pluralist and democratic state and revolution through peaceful means. Haitians took to the streets Thursday to protest the ongoing presence of UN troops, who have been accused of abuse, introducing cholera to the island, and most recently, sexual assault. FSRN's Ansel Hurst reports from Port-au-Prince.
The protest began in Fort National, a dusty hilltop. After a tense standoff with Brazilian UN soldiers, the march wound its way into the Champ de Mars Plaza, where tens of thousands of people displaced by the 2010 earthquake still live in tent camps. The protesters chanted, "Hold on to your pants, MINUSTA are rapists," referencing allegations that five UN soldiers from Uruguay sexually assaulted an 18-year-old Haitian man in August. Haitian police tried to block the march from reaching the palace, firing dozens of tear gas canisters and flash grenades at rock-throwing protesters. As camp dwellers ran from the tear gas, Brigard Peterson told FSRN he blamed the UN and the Haitian government, not the demonstrators, for the disorder around him.
The police are firing tear gas against the protesters who are demanding a departure of MINUSTA because the peacekeepers aren't doing anything serious to give Haiti security. On the contrary, they commit human rights violations against not just women, but men too.
The UN sent a delegation of high-ranking officials to Haiti this week to reinforce its zero-tolerance policy on sexual abuse. Despite ongoing protests, President Michel Martelly is expected to ask the UN Security Council next month to renew the peacekeeping mission's mandate for another year. Ansel Hurz, FSRN, Port-au-Prince.
Extreme flooding in Pakistan has left millions struggling with homelessness, loss of family members, and now disease. Dengue fever has strongly hit the Punjab province, and the international community is attempting to respond. Rose Katabji reads for FSRN's Gabe Matthews in Pakistan.
Older men, women, and children sit on roads in the Sindh province of Pakistan. Dead animals and flood water surround the area. Nigat Kamdar is the project coordinator of the U.S.-based International Medical Corps and says the population desperately needs international support in order to survive.
They are now under the open sky on the roads and on the roadsides. Patients have been increased and acute watery diarrhea is mostly there. And the skin diseases are there. And RTI is there. Basically, it is waterborne diseases there.
The government announced that about 2.3 million people suffer from different diseases after the recent flood, and the number of patients is expected to increase in the coming weeks because of stagnant water in the area. Pakistan has so far received minimal aid from the international community for people displaced by the flood. Reading for Gabe Matthews in Pakistan, I'm Rose Katabji.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Washington, D.C., I'm Alice Olstein.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. As tens of thousands of people continue to recover from this year's devastating disasters nationwide, Congress has yet to give the Federal Emergency Management Agency the money it's desperately in need of. Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington.
48 states are still dealing with unprecedented levels of damage. Floods, wildfires, hurricanes, and tornadoes have ripped through the U.S. Only Michigan and West Virginia have been spared federal disasters this year. Connecticut Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal describes what he's seen traveling across his small state over the past 2 weeks since Hurricane Irene tore through it.
Destruction of small businesses, of homes, rivers, swelling, flooding of historic dimensions causing significant destruction. The wind and rain striking Connecticut with a fury and ferocity virtually unmatched in recent memory.
The storms have also left a massive human toll. In addition to more than 500 killed, thousands of people are now homeless, and many more are cut off from basic supplies. New York Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand says it's a heartbreaking scene.
Hundreds of families living in shelters, complete homes destroyed, belongings piled up on people's front yards, small businesses uncertain whether they would even reopen, worry about whether they could hire back their employees. Farms who had no feed for livestock for days.
All of these federal disasters, and the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, has only around $300 million in its emergency fund. The agency has had to put on hold long-term rebuilding projects, including schools, libraries, and home reconstruction projects in other states, as well as vital road and bridge projects. The reason for the lack of funding is a political battle in Congress over whether to pay for the relief now or in the future. Blumenthal says people in the Northeast are getting by, but they need federal help now.
Communities struck by this storm have reacted with determination and resolve, not with desperation or despair. They are determined and dedicated to rebuild and recover from this storm, but they need help, and that help is provided by FEMA.
House Republicans are demanding the aid be paid for up front, and they passed a bill diverting money for a hybrid vehicle program to pay for it. Tennessee Republican Congressperson Marsha Blackburn says emergencies don't trump dealing with the nation's debt problem.
We have to also realize that we are borrowing 42 cents of every dollar we spend. The American people have said that this has to stop, so what we've got to do is be very careful how we move forward.
In the past, Congress has passed emergency funding for wars and disasters without paying for them up front. But Blackburn says Congress needs to be prepared for unforeseen disasters by setting aside money at the beginning of a fiscal year to prepare for a worst-case scenario.
What we're going to have to do is say, look, we need to plan that every year, just like the states do, you're going to have some unfortunate occurrences. We need to plan all of this into the budget process.
But Democrats like Gillibrand say allowing emergency funding to get hijacked in a political tussle is the wrong way to treat American citizens.
We need immediate funding for FEMA and the USDA disaster assistance to provide relief for these communities all across New York and all of the other states that were affected by these storms.
The Senate passed a version of the emergency bill without the disasters funded. but House Republican leaders are still insisting it be paid for up front. Matt Laszlo, FSRN, Washington.
The 2010 BP oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico killed 11 workers and triggered the largest oil disaster in U.S. history. A long-awaited investigation by the U.S. government has found that the drilling rig explosion was the result of poor risk management, a failure to take into account critical warning signs, and inadequate emergency response training. The Interior Department report released Wednesday calls BP ultimately responsible for the lapses. One of the legacies of the disaster has been concern over the health of Gulf Coast residents and oil spill responders after BP used an unprecedented amount of chemical dispersants. Federal officials are meeting with scientists from around the world in Barcelona as part of a study to find links between health complaints and toxic exposure during the response. FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports.
Health professionals in Gulf states say they are seeing health problems from workers who assisted with the response to last year's massive oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Dale Sandler is the government epidemiologist leading a study to find evidence of a connection.
There are people out there who are sick. There are people who worked on the cleanup. There are people who live near the cleanup who have health complaints, and they think it's due to the oil. It might be coincidence, and it could be due to the oil. We just don't know. But I do get calls from people who are really desperate. They need health care, and they don't have it, and they need somebody to pay attention. So we're trying to answer their questions.
She's joined by Larry Engel, an assistant professor from the University of North Carolina. The epidemiologist says responders and volunteers had some of the highest rates of exposure to crude oil and chemical dispersants with various degrees of protection.
There were people who were actually at the source where the oil was gushing, you know, who were getting probably the highest levels of all the workers who were part of the cleanup operation. There were differences in who had access to protective equipment such as respirators and suits and protective gloves and so on. So, you know, part of what interests me is trying to figure out how to tease apart those differences and use that to answer some of the questions.
Since February, epidemiologists have been trying to reach thousands of people who were involved in the cleanup. Though most came from Gulf states, others were from other parts of the country and have since moved without leaving forward addresses. Sandler says that's unfortunate because the study needs a large sample to show clear evidence if affected workers are to receive treatment or even compensation.
If we showed something, people will have to pay attention. And people are concerned. They think they're sick and nobody's paying attention. But if we find thousands of people with the same complaints, somebody is going to have to pay attention to it.
One of the main challenges researchers face is identifying what specific health problems may have been caused by the spill. Again, Larry Engel.
You know, people are reporting a wide array of symptoms. It has to be kept in mind that it's an underserved community, and one of the things that we're trying to figure out is what symptoms that we're getting are symptoms that result from the oil spill and which ones predate the oil spill. I mean, we know that, you know, this is a community that has needed health care for a long time and hasn't been receiving it. And so, you know, our job, and it's a difficult job, is to tease apart what those long-standing problems are from the ones that have resulted from the oil.
Enrollment in the study closes at the end of the month, but those who do sign up will be tracked over at least the next 5 years. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Barcelona.
Those who worked even a single day in the response effort can get in touch with the researchers by going online to nihgulfstudy.org or by calling toll-free 1-855-NIH-GULF. That's 1-855-NIH-GULF. In August, the Obama administration announced revisions to its deportation policy, which has been criticized for inundating courts with minor offenders and dividing families. Despite the changes, hopes are fading for a farm worker family in the Fresno area. As FSRN reported earlier this month, the Mendoza family had been waiting for relief from the Department of Homeland Security. While the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Office in San Francisco upheld its decision to allow two family members to stay in the U.S. for 1 year, three others have been ordered to report for deportation on September 19th. FSRN's Vic Bedoyan reports from Fresno.
The Mendoza family has lived in the Central Valley for 20 years, working in the agricultural fields. After losing their case for asylum, they appealed to immigration officials for consideration under new guidelines announced by the Department of Homeland Security. According to their attorney, Zachary Nightingale, those new criteria were not applied to the Mendoza family.
This is exactly the kind of family and the kind of individuals that the prosecutorial discretion was intended to address, and which is exactly the reason that I feel and fear that it's been business as usual and not really been a fair adjudication in light of this new publicly stated policy.
The Mendozas operate as an integral unit. The family's patriarch, Isidro, along with his grown son, Salomon, and daughter, Cecilia, are scheduled to be deported. Of the family, only Salomon speaks English. Paula, the matriarch, and daughter, Ilaria, were granted a temporary stay. They speak only the Mixtec language, not English or Spanish. Again, Zachary Nightingale.
The remaining family members are a mix of people with permanent status and people without. But really, Ilaria and her mother are going to have their hands full with the basically five United States citizen youngsters, three minors, two young adults to take care of. And they're worried sick that this is not going to be possible to do. And for the first time in their lives, this family's really going to be split down the middle. And that's what they're terrified of.
Nightingale has made a written request to immigration officials in Washington, D.C. for another review of the case, because the decision made by the San Francisco office seems inconsistent with public announcements made by the federal government. Vic Bedoyan, FSRN, Fresno.
To hear Vic's earlier story featuring voices of the Mendoza family, go to our website, fsrn.org. Earlier this week, Guatemalans went to the polls to vote for national and local leaders. A runoff is now set for November, and the frontrunner is Otto Perez Molina, a former military general during Guatemala's brutal 36-year war. According to the UN, that conflict, the deadliest in the region, killed 250,000 people, many from the country's majority indigenous population. Much of the violence was at the hands of state security forces. Candidate Perez Molina was a powerful figure during some of the worst killings in the 1980s. For more, we speak with Annie Bird. She's co-director of Rights Action, a rights group focused on Central America. She's on mobile phone in Guatemala City. Annie Bird, welcome to FSRN.
Thank you for having me.
Perez Molina has a long military resume. One thing that stands out is his position as commander of a task force in the Ishe Triangle in the 1980s. What is known about what he did during that time?
Well, for instance, there are leaked military documents that demonstrate that he participated in different campaigns that, you know, massacres were part of. Just, for example, one of the campaigns, Escorpio Uno, started out with a massacre on July 17, 1982 that involved 15 people and 9 children.
And for these massacres, such as the one in July 1982 that you refer to in the region, what kind of documentation is there that shows that Perez Molina had some knowledge of it or was involved in some way?
Well, there's also video footage that exists of an interview done in September 1982 by U.S. journalist Alan Nairn. At the time that he met Perez Molina, he used a war name of Chico Adia, but it's clearly Perez Molina. And, you know, that's publicly recognized that he was the one commanding that base and his war name was Chico. And, you know, when the journalists arrived, there were 4 tortured and extrajudicially executed Ishio men laid out on the floor, and Perez Molina gave an interview with the journalists over their bodies.
So there were these victims of the violence there in their presence on the floor?
Exactly.
Now, following the 1980s, Perez Molina then headed the military intelligence unit of the Guatemalan army in the early 1990s. What did this unit do?
Well, when Perez Molina headed the military intelligence unit, the army and the government was negotiating the peace process with the guerrilla movement. And so, you know, the army military intelligence unit under Perez Molina's command ran this program of prolonged torture for 300 secret prisoners.
Now, what you're outlining, this history, they're not secrets. The history is known. It's been documented, as you're saying. Perez Molina has even campaigned for presidency under the slogan of bringing an iron fist to the violence in Guatemala. Why do you think he's receiving the support that he has?
The thing is, he's a very powerful figure. He's someone known to manage a lot of power. In a country that has been subject to so much violence for so many years, there's a significant, identification with power is a significant psychological, reaction that happens among, most of the population. But at the same time, there's also pretty widespread recognition that all of the major political parties, including his, appear to have significant contacts with organized crime, which, is behind the violence.
Annie Bird is co-director of Rights Action. She joined us from Guatemala, where a presidential runoff election is set for November. Annie Bird, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you.
And violence in Guatemala continues even after the election on September 11th. Today, the International Trade Union Confederation is calling for an immediate investigation into the murder of labor leader Byron Arega, who was killed on the morning of September 13th as he got into his car. In India's western state of Maharashtra, the state government introduced two new solar power plants earlier this year. But like previous solar power projects in the state, the grids won't reach the interior rural areas. A network of NGOs and solar light manufacturers in the country aims to change that. And some rural villages are now seeing light after sunset. FSRN's Gayatri Lakshambai reports from rural Maharashtra.
It's 7:30 in the evening in Sapada, a tiny tribal hamlet about 200 miles northeast of Mumbai. The villagers are rushing from the fields after their day's work. They want to be home before the darkness sets in. Sapada is one of hundreds of villages in Maharashtra that doesn't have access to electricity. Though it falls under the electric grid set by the state government, the reality is that Sapada doesn't have power for over 12 hours a day. Veera Kamle is a young mother in the village who gave birth to her 3-month-old daughter without the benefit of electricity.
I gave birth to her in total darkness, but there were no complications. The midwives are now trained to do this. Of course, it would be better with power and electricity.
For ages, life in Sapada began at dawn and ended by dusk. After nightfall, the villagers used dim kerosene lamps, a source that emits carcinogenic fumes and causes fire-related accidents. Vishnu Kashinath Kamle lives in a small mud hut in Sapada with his wife and 4 children.
The kerosene lamps are bad because of the fumes. They leave a soot on the walls. We've also heard stories about a lot of fire accidents because of them. And they are expensive too. It costs $3 to $4 every month.
But the recent introduction of portable solar lights is changing life after sunset for the villagers.
The solar lamps have been very helpful. We don't have to deal with the fumes anymore. It's so much safer. And it helps in saving money. I paid $7 to get this. It's been 10 months and I have already made up for the money I spent for kerosene. This is a one-time investment and it is good savings.
At night, the fields around the village are pitch dark. Walking through them is dangerous. There's always a risk of insects, snakes, thorns, and nettles. But things have been made easier with the portable solar lamps, which can easily be carried to the fields. Gopal Dive, the head of the village, uses the solar lamp to work at night. This, he says, is something he wasn't able to do earlier.
I use my lamp in the fields. My father and other farmers are using it right now to plant rice seeds in the fields. It can be used during watering as well. The crop hasn't yielded yet, but the lights are really handy in the sowing season. It's useful to see where the paths in the fields turn. Initially, we would farm at night without lights and suffer from snake bites and thorn pricks, but now we don't have to deal with that anymore.
A Mumbai-based NGO called Eve Foundation has helped subsidize the solar lights for the village. Eve, which stands for Empowering Villages Everywhere, is an initiative started by three Mumbai teenagers. Jash and Nishka Chaurarya and Nikhil Lalwani began this project when they were still in school. On a casual trip to rural India, they discovered how life was different and in some ways more difficult than the one they were accustomed to in a big city like Mumbai. They realized that light was one of the most important aspects missing from the lives of the villagers. They heard stories of village kids not being able to study just because they had no electricity. Moved by this experience, Jash Chaurarya said they decided to do something about the situation.
This whole incident happened in April. And then from that point onwards, once we saw it, we couldn't leave it because it was something that became really close to us. And so during the summer of 2010, what we really decided to do is try and accumulate the funds to subsidize the solar lamps to all the different villages all over India, which we started connecting to and sending a few samples to see how the response was. And the response was overwhelming. I mean, we had villages full of demand sheets, which covered like 6 to 7 pages. And we decided that subsidizing the lamp is the right thing to do simply because giving it to them for free doesn't give them any sense of ownership and responsibility.
Eve then approached many corporate firms in Mumbai to raise funds to subsidize these lamps for the villagers. A Mumbai-based firm called Greenlight Planet, run by young entrepreneurs, developed the lamp, and a network of NGOs helps distribute them. This collective effort, Jash says, has managed to light up 15,000 homes across more than 260 villages in India.
You know, everyone talks about this is India's time, India shining, but honestly, India shining isn't constricted to those tier one cities we have, Bombay, Delhi, Chennai, but not even the tier two. But if India is truly to shine, it's really about reaching out to these villages and these people and helping empower them in ways which they couldn't have and giving them these extra hours in the day to do so much more.
Back in Sappada, it's dinner time. For the first time since they settled in the village, the villagers aren't eating in darkness anymore. I join one of the families for a meal. A guest in the house, Koshabha Kamble, complains about not having these lights at his home in Devargaon, a few miles away.
We make do with battery-run flashlights, which are expensive. We have to work at night with that. It's very difficult. We live in darkness most of the time. We don't have a choice. We can't ask the night to not fall. Simple chores like going to the forest or fields become difficult. But what can we do? We take a stick in our hands and set out at night. The company that provides these lights hasn't come to my village yet. I don't know why. If they distribute these lights in my village too, it would be useful for all of us.
With over 60% of India's rural population having no access to electricity, the task ahead for Eve, its collaboration of NGOs and Greenlight Planet is massive. The state government does have a solar plant initiative which will eventually develop power grids in rural areas. Meanwhile, initiatives like Eve are taking smaller steps to overcome rural India's current power deficit. Gayatri Lakshmi Bai, FSRN, Sappada.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.